This is Curious Minnesota, a Star Tribune project that sends staff from the state's largest newsroom hunting for the answers to great questions we receive from you, our readers. We're here to answer everything you want to know about the state's people, places, and culture.
Welcome to Curious Minnesota. I'm your host, Eric Roper. Today's episode of Curious Minnesota is sponsored by Primrose Schools. The familiar image of a stoic Native American chief wearing a headdress is in many ways a core American cultural stereotype. It has been memorialized in films and statues, as well as exploited to sell cigarettes and motorcycles. Native chiefs even had a starring role in the most watched sporting event in American history earlier this year, when the Kansas City Chiefs won Super Bowl 58. But who are these celebrated figures of the past? Rob Robertson asked Curious Minnesota to write about Minnesota's prominent chiefs and explain what roles these chiefs played. Here's Rob.
The reason I was so interested in knowing about the Indian chiefs was I recently visited Fort Ridgely. It was the main fort involved in the Sioux Uprising. That's where the big battles were. And I was just curious about all the Native American chiefs that were here in Minnesota. It's really hard to find information on any of that. And I thought maybe, you know, Curious Minnesota could come up with something very interesting. And you guys really did.
Thanks to Rob for that question. Joining me today is graphics artist Mark Boswell, who wrote a story on this topic for Curious Minnesota. Well, Mark, thanks so much for joining us today. So we go way back here in the newsroom, because whenever I have a wacky idea back in the day of some infrastructure thing I just need to show people in graphical form, I come to Mark, and Mark will start drawing it in front of me, which is always like, I have pictures of you doing this. It's kind of amazing to me that you can create these things on the fly. We've done wastewater. How does that get treated? I think one of my favorite ones is like how many IDS towers will get filled up by the garbage that we landfill. And we spent quite a while figuring out the volume of IDS tower. And then we did the river wall underneath St. Anthony Falls, which took us months, and engineers and all sorts of people were consulted with that.
I think the river wall is interesting because you can't see it.
Right.
It's under the river. And I think it shocks people to think, my God, there's tunnels under there. So that it was the perfect example of all the things you were describing to do in graphical form. You can't take a picture of it.
Yeah. So to your background specifically, because it relates to this story and you were really drawn to this question, tell us a little bit about where you grew up, because you grew up in Minnesota on a reservation.
I'm an enrolled member of the White Earth Nation. I grew up in northwestern Minnesota on the White Earth Indian Reservation. If you can imagine someplace north of Detroit Lakes and west of Itasca Park, really pretty area, lots of lakes and tree cover. And then out on the west, it turns into prairie and farmland. So it's a big mix of biomes there.
And how did you learn about Native history growing up?
I kind of did it piecemeal, but it was always there. You know, in the summer, you'd go to powwows, or, you know, my grandma did beadwork, stuff like that. So there was a lot of pride in craft and heritage.
You eventually started learning about some of these chiefs and things like that?
The history is a little bit more hidden, but for anybody interested in it is there. And it was quite a bit later that I kind of got interested in that. And then later on, I worked for a little newspaper in Bemidji, the Ojibwe News. And there I kind of really took a deep dive in the history and politics of the region.
And you became intrigued by these chiefs. What it sort of drew you to them?
I think that it's the sense that they really existed in a really tumultuous time. And one of the more fascinating things are basically photographs of a lot of these chiefs in ceremonial garb with basically eagle feathers that they'd, you know, gotten in battle or doing deeds. And a lot of the things that they hold in photographs are really symbolic.
So we've already used this word chiefs a couple of times in this conversation, but you point out in the story that this is sort of it's an English word, and the reality is much more nuanced than this sort of singular concept of a chief that we imagine maybe in our minds.
Yeah, I think most readers are going to see Indian chiefs as basically warrior types, whereas in the real communities, there were other leaders. There were ceremonial leaders. There were basically cultural leaders, a lot of other of these terms that could be leaders were very well respected, but there were also war leaders.
So a tribe might have, or a community might have, several different chiefs potentially?
Yes, and they were all voted in by consensus. There was a real sense of democracy amongst communities where a particular person would be appointed to that position and held it as long as he could with his own persuasion, charisma, doing good deeds. And so things moved along. So a chief could also fall out of favor.
Mm-hmm. You note in the story that historically a lot of chiefs kind of followed almost like a monarchy system of hereditary leadership.
Yes, there were hereditary warrior clan chiefs, and through a lot of time, they came from that clan and they did a good job.
And then that evolved later to more of some of these people leading by personality?
Yeah, I think the pressures of colonization, the pressures of an influx of whites coming from the East, the movement of the Dakota and Ojibwe, and then warfare between the Dakota and Ojibwe forced them to change their traditional ways. And amongst the Ojibwe, traditional leadership changed.
Right. And let's talk a little bit about, because you mentioned the colonization there, if you're a chief in some of these contexts, it's a very potentially uncomfortable role, right? If you're sort of the spokesperson, depending on which type of chief you are, but if you're sort of a spokesperson and you're cutting deals with these white colonizers, you might not be so popular back home potentially.
They were between a rock and a hard place. And a lot of the decisions were hard decisions. And basically for the betterment of the community, decisions that had to be made. Of course, we know now that any political decision, you can find different interpretations of it on both sides. Mm-hmm. So they were in a tough spot.
So when we think about Native American chiefs in Minnesota, if you were to ask someone on the street, who's the first person that comes to mind for most people?
In Minnesota, the person that comes to anyone's mind who knows a little bit about history would be Little Crow.
Okay. Let's talk about why Little Crow has become such a prominent name. To understand that, we have to go to the 1860s and the sort of situation of the Dakota people at that period, right?
In the early 1860s, the Dakota were living in pretty desperate means along the Minnesota River Valley, like northwest of Mankato. And they had basically agreed to move there to vacate lands in southern Minnesota so that white farmers could come in and set up shop. And the agreements basically said that we would get payment for ceding these lands. And even the infrastructure was there. But by that time, the United States was deep in the Civil War. Things were not moving along so well, and the Dakota were starving.
Okay.
So they were in desperate means.
And so this sort of leads to the U.S.-Dakota War. I mean, how does that transpire?
The war was basically a desperate response to their situation. When you're starving, you're starving. And there was a lot of pressure to group and fight back. And the Dakota knew that there were reserves of food. They knew that there were annuities to be paid to them so they could maintain their livelihood, and it collapsed into open warfare. At first, Little Crow said, let's not do this, but it's also well documented that once hostilities began, he said, I will lead you. He was a warrior. He was a warrior of warrior class, so he did lead them. It eventually, tragically ended with the exile of huge numbers of Dakota from Minnesota. There were a few pockets that remained. They were considered friendlies, and he was banished out west and into Canada, and eventually came back, but he was murdered at one point.
Wow.
Immediately following hostilities, when it was basically put down, thousands of Dakota were imprisoned on an island below Fort Snelling, Pike Island.
Right.
There are some photographs of hundreds of teepees down there.
Right.
And they were there for a long time, and a lot of people died, starvation and disease. Terrible.
And we should point out that a number of years ago, Kurt Brown, who was a reporter here and still writes a history column here, he did a series about Little Crow that was turned into an ebook. So anybody listening that really wants to get into that history, you can check out the Star Tribune's ebook on that topic.
I think Kurt Brown did a great job because he had enough time to really get into the texture of the times, the historical situation, and really get into the motivations of the Dakota during the conflict. And it was well done and very balanced.
We'll be right back.
At Primrose, our balanced learning approach means exploring academic skills and life skills, combining purposeful play with nurturing guidance from teachers, and setting children up for success in future classrooms. Learn more at primroseschools.com/Twin Cities.
And we're back. One name that some of us have seen, it's a county and it's a city, is Wabasha. And this also relates to the U.S.-Dakota War. Now, there's a number of Wabashas. You, I think, pointed out Wabasha 2 in your story in particular, but there's three of them, and we couldn't get into each history. But tell us a little bit about Wabasha 2, because it relates to the previous story we were just talking about.
Wabasha was a well-respected and decorated warrior in his own terms, and had fought and also made lots of decisions for the benefit of his community. During this Dakota conflict in 1862, he basically found himself in a situation where he did not agree with the hostilities and eventually even basically formed a peace party to try to quell the basic slaughter. And I think was a humane decision, a rational decision on his part.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have this person respected on both sides. So right. It's really an interesting legacy.
Yeah. So Hole in the Days, this actually refers to two Ojibwe leaders. First of all, Hole in the Days, that's probably an anglicization of a native word. So what does that mean?
His name in Ojibwe was Baganagishig. And the real meaning may have been kind of lost in time as far as the translation. It could mean a sort of spirit hole through the sky or a cloud. It could even mean an eclipse. There was some description that could be that. The Hole in the Day, the elder, born in 1800, so long time back and in a different time. And they were, along this frontier, were fighting with the Dakota. There was a lot of hostilities about this region between the Dakota and the Ojibwe, who were pressuring and moving westward.
And are they just fighting for territory, essentially?
Territory, prestige, revenge, all of it. And his son, who was born about 1825, he was kind of grooming him to take over his leadership position. And he died, the elder died in 1847 under tragic situation.
And the elder is like, I mean, he was a warrior, essentially.
Yeah. If you had anybody that was a tough guy, it was Hole in the Day, the elder. His son kind of takes over the reins. And again, we have to emphasize that neither one of these guys came from that warrior class. They assumed the throne. They pressured themselves. They moved in. They took over this sort of power vacuum. And Hole in the Day, the younger, very controversial move on his part, he decides to become the spokesman for the Ojibwe in the entire region.
Okay.
There's a lot of resentment for that, you know, decision on his part, because these different communities had distinct leaders. There was no overarching leader, but he assumed that role. And
but this is at a significant time, in part because the creation of the White Earth Reservation is happening.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure to move the Ojibwe out of Minnesota and Wisconsin to some place where they could be managed, was really the idea. And the White Earth was chosen. It was not a reservation, but they said, let's choose a place where all the resources are there. We can move the Ojibwe and solve that question. And Hole in the Day, the younger, says, wait a minute, we have to take care of a specific element, because there were a lot of corrupt traders. There were a lot of the middlemen between the government and the tribes who were basically taking a cut here, making up debt and sucking up a lot of the annuity payments that were legitimately meant for these Indian communities. Holand today, the younger, really wants to renegotiate and rethink the formation of White Earth, but there were elements that didn't want him involved. They wanted to keep that pressure. They wanted to keep that middleman factor so that when they did move to White Earth, they could continue on, you know, basically profiteering.
And this results in his downfall?
Yeah, he was assassinated. A group of pillager Indians from Leech Lake confronted him on his way. He was leaving on his way to Washington and assassinated him near Gull Lake. And it sort of set the stage for basically a lot of the collapse of the sort of cultural solidarity amongst the Ojibwe, because he really did kind of move into that position.
And who was behind these assassins?
It was later found out that a white and mixed blood trader had hired the assassins. And these are the guys who basically had been running the show in the Gull Lake region at the Crow Wing Agency for a long time. So they had the power, they had the wherewithal.
And was anybody ever prosecuted for that?
What's interesting there were no laws that could prosecute Indian on Indian violence. They were the others, so that there was a big gray area there on whether or not they could prosecute. So it basically turned out that the assassins who were known basically had gone free.
Hmm.
A lot of them later in life did describe their actions, and the investigation went on for a very long time.
Hmm. Interesting. And you note in the story that not all Native chiefs were men, although pretty much the majority of them or most of them were men. But there were some women, female chiefs. What are some examples of that? Ruth Flatmouth is one that you call out.
Yeah, there was a prominent chief, very well-respected Leech Lake chief called Flatmouth. And when he was gone or in the field, his wife became that sort of proxy spokesman. And she was good at it. And later on, when he passed away, basically the power was shifted to her. So she was a full chief.
And she was like doing things you mentioned diplomatic events and things like that she was involved with.
Yes, she filled in the position of her husband, Flatmouth, and took over those duties and became recognized as a chief.
And there was even a female sort of warrior type chief in the North Dakota area?
Yeah.
What's now North Dakota?
I found very little information on a warrior chief, Ogamai Kwe, which basically translates as chief woman, from the Turtle Mountain Indian Reservation way up in North Dakota. And that chief, remarkably, was a leader in warfare as well. That was very interesting.
Yeah. So bringing this to modern day, tribes have evolved a lot, and there's tribal governments now. Or do they still have chiefs in the same way?
It's a little different. But in some cases, the current leaders are in fact descendant from those hereditary chiefs. In a place like Mille Lacs, there are some ceremonial chiefs who are literally called chiefs. But again, that moves away from war. These are ceremonial chiefs. And in Red Lake, which has a different form of government, even their flag has the totems on it. There are people there who are, again, descended from those old hereditary chiefs. So it does live on.
Yeah. So you put this story out there. I thought it was a great story. What did you hear back from people? I mean, we always are interested in the feedback that we hear from people. What was the response?
I got some response from people that said that they were so happy and they had no idea mm-hmm. that the history here could be so textural and is so textural. And we had to cherry pick these specific leaders because, we only have so much space.
Right.
And so these four leaders we chose to talk about are amongst dozens of prominent and respected and really fascinating leaders throughout the region.
And we gave more, the story spent a fair amount of time talking about the notion of these chiefs. So there was limited real estate, obviously. We're leading into some of the people who said, hey, you didn't mention such and such and so and so, which is always a challenge, right? Especially in our business.
It's so hard to pick a specific thing. I think the obvious ones of Little Crow and the Hole in the Days and Wabasha, a sign of kind of an aside, I think these are the obvious picks. But again, you just have to find some that are represented not only of those individuals, what they might have done, but also give some sense of the textural moment and time that they lived.
Right. And a key source for this story was Dr. Anton Troyer, who's been a guest on this podcast.
Yeah, Anton Troyer is really the go-to guy for a lot of the history, and he's a fascinating guy and a remarkable linguist as well.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much. I'm glad you wrote this story for us, and you were drawn to it, and I like when someone's drawn to a topic because I know they're going to be passionate about it, and you're passionate about this.
Thank you, Eric, and I'll end with this. I'll say Migrich Bizendawieg, which is thank you for listening to me.
I love it. And what language is it in?
Ojibwe.
Great. Thank you. Okay, that's it for today's show. Thanks, as always, to Matt Gilmer for editing this podcast. Do you have feedback for us or a question you'd like us to tackle? Send us a note at curious@startribune.com. And if you're enjoying this show, please tell a friend about it. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Curious Minnesota. We want to hear from you. Ask questions and read more stories online at startribune.com/curious. Our show is recorded at the Star Tribune's headquarters in beautiful downtown Minneapolis, and our music is produced by Matt Gilmer. If you like the show, please rate us on iTunes or leave a review. And until next time, stay curious.